this would preclude us from being able to protest, our basic First Amendment rights to free speech are being stifled.
The ACLU sues to overturn the sidewalk sitting ban in Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 31st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a submersible in the Aleutians uncovers the New York City of the seascape world.
Really quickly, it just became clear that it was something remarkable. Thousands and thousands of them just piled on top of each other over a really large area.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Monday, February 18th. Call 1-800-478-1456 for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The ACLU of Alaska is challenging the municipality of Anchorage law on sidewalk sitting and panhandling. They say the law is unconstitutional. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Jeffrey Mittman is the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska. He says the ordinance adopted by the Anchorage Assembly created two distinct unconstitutional sections in Anchorage Municipal Code that are in conflict with the Alaska Constitution.
As Alaskans, we depend upon our incredibly strong Constitution, which we're all very proud of, and our Alaska Constitution is very clear. This ordinance is not permissible.
The law bans most sitting or lying down and panhandling on downtown sidewalks. It was adopted by the Assembly in November 2011. ACLU attorneys argue the ordinance violates freedom of expression and infringes on the right to peaceably assemble. The ACLU wrote letters to the Assembly expressing concern about the change in law. The Assembly repealed the ordinance in September 2012. Mayor Dan Sullivan quickly vetoed the repeal. Joshua Decker is the ACLU attorney handling the case. He says the ACLU has reached out to municipal officials hoping to amend the code.
We're very happy to work with the municipality to craft laws that address problems of sitting on the sidewalk, problems of obstructing traffic, but they should be well-tailored to Alaska and well-tailored to Anchorage, and sadly, these laws are not.
Decker says the mayor's office has not been responsive. The ACLU is concerned that the law could be used to prevent workers from protesting and artists from performing. The eight plaintiffs signed on to the lawsuit range in age from 26 to 95 years old and from liberal to libertarian. They include activists in the Occupy movement and an artist. Two labor unions have also signed on to the lawsuit. Vince Beltrami is president of the Alaska AFL-CIO. He says he's concerned that workers protesting unfair labor practices could be arrested.
Oftentimes, workers, may have issues that put us on the street protesting, poor treatment or whatnot, maybe unfair labor practices that have been committed by, an employer or, city government officials, for that matter. And this would, preclude us from being able to protest, our basic First Amendment rights to free speech are, being stifled if we don't stand up for this.
Beltrami says that he doesn't know of any workers who've been fined or arrested while protesting since the ordinances were put in place. Tika Ballas is an artist who runs the city's art magazine. She's concerned the law could prevent her from performing in downtown Anchorage.
I just really hope that there's a rewarding that comes with this so that people can still sit and eat their lunch and not have the threat of maybe being harassed by police officers or fined by police officers, and that as a performance artist, I can continue to do art in a visible area. If you want to busk, if you want to do flash mob, if you want to protest, the only real reasonable place to do that is downtown Anchorage. And right now, currently, we don't have that right.
Anchorage Police Department officials say that they have not yet cited anyone using the law since it went on the books, but they have enforced it by asking people to leave the sidewalk. Mayor Sullivan proposed the sidewalk sitting law after a homeless man, John Martin, was camped out in front of City Hall in 2011, protesting the mayor's policy of clearing out homeless camps in Anchorage. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Late in the day, Dennis Wheeler, an attorney for the municipality of Anchorage, said he was surprised by the lawsuit filed by the ACLU today.
We spent a significant amount of time and effort to craft an ordinance that we felt met the constitutional requirements, and that's why we spent so much time working to model it as closely as we could after the Seattle version that had gone through the federal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and had withstood a constitutional challenge by, among others, the ACLU. So we feel very comfortable that we've crafted something that works.
Wheeler adds it has never been the intention of the municipality to interfere with people's ability to freely assemble. Next week, the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council may start work on zoning the ocean, something it began in 2005 when it protected the coral gardens of the Aleutian Islands. This time, seascape nursery areas are being considered. The council's preferred alternative would avoid restricting fishing in these areas, instead directing the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to keep an eye on them. But this issue may set the stage for deliberations later this year on two large canyons in the Bering Sea that are full of corals, sponges, and skates. APRN's Steve Heimel has a report.
The pressure campaign on the Pribilof and Zemchug canyons is beginning to build in preparation for a council meeting in June, where a staff analysis will be presented. The Greenpeace Foundation began its campaign after a 2007 submarine expedition that mapped large areas of both canyons and documented the presence of sponges and corals in higher densities than other marine areas, and even found some new species. Researchers were glad to get the data, agreeing with Greenpeace's Oceans campaign head John Hosovar that it's better than counting the stuff that comes up along with the fish in trawl nets.
You know, we learn a lot from trawl surveys, from bycatch programs, from fishery-dependent data, but in my mind, there's no substitute for this kind of in-situ data where you go down there and you see it firsthand and you come back with video and you can see how things actually work when they're still alive.
Greenpeace returned with two more submersibles this year and did more surveys. They're trying to build the case to make the canyons off-limits to bottom trawling and maybe longline fishing as well. Hosovar says in their 2007 survey, they saw 13 places where the seafloor was disturbed by fishing. This time, they saw 79.
We saw quite a bit more impact from especially trawling and also from bottom long lines. And I think the main difference is that this time we were concentrating at depths where there's more fishing pressure.
The council will hear a progress report on the canyon analysis at its meeting next week in Portland. Mike Sigler of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Juneau is heading the project. His recommendations will come out in June, but he's willing to talk about what they'll be based on, deciding how distinct the canyon is biologically from the rest of the edge of the continental shelf, an area already so productive that they're calling it the Green Belt.
And I think the crux of it is, are the canyons different from the adjacent slope habitat? In other words, if you walk your way along the Green Belt, when you hit the canyons, are they an oasis or are they, you know, similar to other steep habitat in the slope habitat in the Bering Sea?
If the canyons are distinct, the next question becomes how much of them should be protected?
What are the scales of what do you want to protect in a zoning system? Are you going to treat each of the ecosystems, the Aleutians, the southeastern Bering Sea as distinct or not, or all part of one system and then you want to protect some fraction of those? And how much is enough? We'll provide the scientific information, but those are policy things for the council to consider.
Both canyons contain seamount areas where the triangular flatfish, the seascate, for some unknown reason, deposits its eggs in great concentration, says John Hosovar.
I felt like a kid in a candy store. It was the coolest thing that we saw moving upslope in one of the pinnacles in Zemchug Canyon. And all of a sudden, you start seeing a couple skate egg cases, which I've never seen in a submarine before. The only place I've ever seen them is on a beach. And then really quickly, it just became clear that it was something remarkable. Thousands and thousands of them just piled on top of each other over a really large area, you know, easily the size of a football field, it looked like.
The council has been discussing what to do about the seascape nurseries for close to 3 years. Beyond the two canyons, four other areas have been identified, all called habitat areas of particular concern. At its Portland meeting, the council will look at three alternatives: no action, restricting fishing, or just keeping an eye on the areas. Food retailer Safeway and several native organizations have joined the Greenpeace Canyon Conservation Campaign. The Center for Biological Diversity, known for its litigation on habitat conservation, says the current level of coral bycatch by the trawl fleet is unsustainable. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a look at the whooping cough outbreak in Alaska.
The vast majority of cases were occurring in children, with 75% of cases occurring in people under 20.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the 2013 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
The state's long-held dream of an Arctic deepwater port has moved one step closer to reality. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers released a draft report yesterday that names the Nome-Port Clarence region as the best location for the port. It will be the subject of an upcoming feasibility study, which will help further determine a site. Lorraine Cordova is the Corps' project manager.
The Nome and Port Clarence area bubbled up to the top in part because there's naturally deep water there, and they've got the upland support that many of the other communities lacked. And this is not to imply that there's going to be construction of anything. We're really still in the feasibility stage. It's going to take another 2 years to get through with the feasibility report, and then we don't know where the funds will come from for construction. So this study does not imply construction of any kind.
The State Department of Transportation and Public Facilities has partnered with the Corps on studying the possibility of an Arctic port system since 2008. Increased vessel traffic in the Arctic is prompting the move toward an Alaska port somewhere in the Northwest. About 60% of the vessels cruising past the state's shores are foreign flagged, a fact that is of increasing concern to the U.S. Coast Guard. The Coast Guard is party to an international agreement to provide search and rescue in the Arctic. A federal act of 2012 directs the Coast Guard to complete a study on an Arctic port to protect U.S. sovereignty and resource issues in the area. Cordova says the Corps is aiming for a 2014 release of the draft Nome site study. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski is trying to make a natural gas pipeline from the North Slope more feasible. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, environmentalists are welcoming a stretch of pipeline through Denali National Park.
Senator Murkowski introduced a bill that would allow a 7-mile stretch of pipeline to run through the national park. For that to happen, Congress needs to pass a law granting approval. She says it creates an equal playing field for proposed routes along the Richardson and Parks highways.
Once the decision was made which way to go, we wanted there to be a clear path forward.
The pipeline would be buried through the park's industrial corridor. Jim Stratton says the plan presents the best possible option. He's the regional director for the National Parks Conservation Association.
Burying it along the highway through Denali National Park makes way more sense to us than, you know, going to the east and, you know, and putting a new road and putting a new pipeline in what is essentially, you know, virgin wilderness right now.
And there's an added boost, says Larry Persily. He's the federal coordinator for the Alaska Gas Pipeline. He says that in addition to making it easier for producers, this legislation could add to the health of the park's economy because it would allow park operators to access some of the cleaner burning fuel.
It's been talked about for years. If there's a pipeline nearby, there are a lot of environmental and cost advantages to using natural gas for the hotels, for the businesses, for vehicles instead of continuing to burn diesel.
Of course, granting the go-ahead to a 7-mile stretch of what would be a route that extends hundreds of miles is not the major barrier to construction. That's something Senator Murkowski readily concedes.
This did nothing to resolve whether or not we even do it. When you're looking at alternate routes, if one route is complicated because of the proposed path, if you can correct that ahead of time so that that's not an issue, it doesn't take away the big issue, which of course is the price tag.
And that price tag could total as much as $60 billion. This bill passed out of the Senate last Congress on a voice vote, meaning there was no opposition. But it did not receive a vote in the House. So the process begins anew, with votes required in both chambers. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Right now, if you and a group of like-minded individuals want to set up a charter school in your community, you need to petition your local school board to get the plan approved. A new bill could change that and open authorization to universities, other government agencies, and nonprofits. Representative Lynn Gaddis, a Republican from Wasilla, is behind the bill. She says the intent is to make it easier for charter schools to get up and running.
Parents are clamoring for it. Parents in the Anchorage School District are saying, hey, come on, we're in line. We're year after year, we're waiting.
The way the bill works is that a group would first have to get approved by the state's education department to set up and administer a school. After that, they would be given the same responsibilities that school districts now have in tracking a school's effectiveness and potentially revoking a school's charter if they're not meeting standards. These schools would operate under the same state funding formulas as charters set up by school boards. The bill also allows charters to hire teachers who aren't subject to collective bargaining agreements. That provision of the bill doesn't sit well with Ron Furr. He's the president of the National Education Association's Alaska affiliate, a labor organization.
It just appears to be kind of a backdoor attack on collective bargaining in the state of Alaska for public school teachers.
Furr says that bill could establish a two-tier system where charters could employ both unionized and non-unionized teachers, and that would create confusion over what benefits those non-unionized teachers would receive. Furr says the bill could also take local control away from school boards and could reduce enrollment and funding for existing public schools. Gaddis says some teachers have called her with some of those same worries.
They're all valid concerns, but here's what I say. You got a great school. You're doing great things. You don't have to worry. You don't have to worry that somebody wants to charterize. If you're responsive to your customers, the parents and the students, those school districts or those schools, they don't have to worry.
Gaddis adds that her bill could, in effect, create a more competitive education market, and she sees that as a strength. And as chair of the House Education Committee, Gaddis has the muscle to get the bill in motion at the very least. She says she intends to schedule it for a hearing soon.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Meridian Management, specializing in coordination and management of all phases of construction projects from vision to completion, working to ensure that your project is on time and on budget. More at meridianak.com. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The Matanuska Susitna Borough is offering to give away the ice-breaking ferry Susitna. Borough officials want to give away the ship to federal, state, or local governments because it is costing the borough too much money to maintain it. The borough will also consider selling the ferry to a private entity. The Susitna was built with federal dollars as a U.S. Navy prototype vessel. It can hold 20 vehicles and 120 passengers. It was supposed to serve passengers between Port McKenzie and Anchorage. The borough has not been successful in finding a landing site for the vessel on the Anchorage side of Kinnick Arm, and the borough does not have funds to maintain the ship. Borough spokeswoman Patty Sullivan says the borough could sell the ferry to a private company for about $7 million, enough to cover federal grants the borough may have to pay back. Last year, the rate of pertussis, or whooping cough, in Alaska reached epidemic proportions, and it's likely the epidemic is ongoing. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
On Wednesday, the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services released a bulletin outlining the details of last year's pertussis epidemic in Alaska. Brian Yablon is a medical epidemiologist with the Alaska Department of Health.
What we found, which is consistent with what we know about pertussis, is that the vast majority of cases were occurring in children, with 75% of cases occurring in people under 20, and the majority of those childhood cases occurring in early childhood, as well as in school-aged children.
Last year, there were 356 documented cases of pertussis in Alaska. That's well above the case counts for the previous 3 years. According to the epidemiology bulletin, case counts increased precipitously in late July and remained high through the last week of December. There were 178 pertussis cases in the Anchorage-Matsu region last year, with 71 cases in the interior and 16 cases in southwest Alaska. Yablon asserts the epidemic is ongoing.
There's no evidence at this time that pertussis is decreasing. We know that there's still widespread pertussis occurring throughout Alaska.
The Alaska Department of Health was able to determine the vaccination status for 80% of the pertussis cases last year, and nearly 60% of the people were up to date with their vaccinations. The highest rate of infection was among Alaska natives, with an incidence rate of 71 per every 100,000 people. Yablon says that data might be a bit misleading.
We had a disproportionate number of case reports of pertussis among Alaska Natives. And what's difficult to know is whether that represents that, in fact, Alaska Natives were disproportionately affected by pertussis in 2012, which is one possibility, or whether it represents that the clinics and providers who are taking care of Alaska Native patients are thinking pertussis more and sending more tests.
The epidemiology bulletin released Wednesday shows that in 2012, the incidence of reported pertussis cases in Alaska was over four times the national average. However, there are a number of states reporting higher rates than Alaska. Yablon says the high illness rate among Alaska children between the ages of 10 to 14 suggests a waning immunity from the pertussis vaccine. He says the old vaccine that most adults would have received had a high side effect profile.
As a result, a newer vaccine about 15 years ago replaced that in the United States. What has been sort of found since the initiation of the use of this vaccine is that it's been necessary to add a booster dose for young adolescents because the effectiveness, the immunity that people get from that vaccine does wear off over time in a way that it wasn't evident that the old vaccine was doing.
You can find the epidemiology bulletin about last year's epidemic of pertussis in Alaska on the website of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
One of Southeast's most prominent environmental organizations has started a marketing campaign for timber. The Sitka Conservation Society recently printed a glossy brochure selling the virtues of second-growth Tongass timber for projects from furniture to housing. The only problem is there's no way yet to economically harvest and process second growth. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
SCS Director Andrew Tomes is the first to admit that an industry based on second growth may be decades away, but he doesn't think it's too early for wood users to consider local products.
As we think long term about where we get our resources, how local we live, the cost of shipping things, and our overall carbon footprint, we need to start looking more locally at where we get our resources. And eventually we're going to have to build the economy and the networks where we're able to buy wood that comes from the region rather than from across the continent.
The brochure that SCS has produced is called Alaskan Grown, a guide to Tongass young growth timber and its uses. It features a pair of recreational log cabins built by the Forest Service in Sitka and Wrangell, a private residence in Gustavus, and a recent project in the Sitka High School wood shop using red alder to build nightstands. None of the wood for these projects was purchased through conventional means, but Tome says there are networks of small-scale mills from Hoonah to Wrangell to Prince of Wales that can be a reasonable alternative for people willing to try something that, for now, remains unconventional.
We've heard anecdotally from some of the builders in town that once they have figured out where they get their supply of local wood, the prices are cheaper or comparable to buying all their wood from that comes from someplace else in the country rather than here.
You know, Alaska young growth is no different than any other tree that grows in North America.
Alan Brackley is the director of the Forest Service's Pacific Northwest Research Station in Sitka.
Be it lumber or pulp and paper or particle board or plywood or engineered products, you can make them out of Alaska young growth.
Brackley says the one limitation on young growth is that it cannot produce sawn clear boards. That is a feature of old growth and why it remains so valuable. Brackley does not view the turn to young growth in the Tongass as especially innovative. Young growth is the name of the game in much of the nation's timber industry.
You go down to Washington and Oregon, they've almost totally converted to a young growth economy. Not only have they converted to a young growth economy, some of the industrial forest lands, they have made the transition from young growth to almost a plantation, highly managed stand type situation.
Roughly 1 million acres of the Tongass was clear cut during the pulp mill era between 1960 and 1990 and is now in second growth. But the rate of regrowth, despite Southeast's uniform appearance from the air, is really variable. Brackley says a lot of people are working on projecting sustainable yields through time in the Tongass, but time in this forest works on a different scale. Brackley thinks we're 30 to 40 years out from having enough young growth to sustain major industry again.
But right now, there is no possibility that you could support anything other than a very, very small industry.
Brackley says that projection could change with more study. The SDS brochure lays these facts on the line, but Andrew Tomes is undeterred. He says the Sitka Conservation Society just wanted to show agencies and potential users what is possible with young growth and to point the way to a more sustainable economic future for Southeast communities. He hopes many previously clear-cut areas will be set aside and not logged again for young growth, and some wood, like yellow cedar, is just too slow-growing to be a practical young growth product. Tomes is just as deliberate in spreading the word about young growth. You probably won't find a printed copy of this brochure except at the SCS office.
We want to use as little as wood as possible and reduce our amount of paper, and I think that people can read this real well on the internet.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And finally tonight, a correction. In a story that aired yesterday, we reported that former Anchorage Assemblymember Dan Coffey faced a maximum fine from the Alaska Public Offices Commission of $46,500, which was reduced to $13,000. The maximum amount was actually $36,500. That was reduced to nearly $12,000. APOC staff say former Anchorage Assemblymember Dan Coffey failed to register as a lobbyist for the municipality of Anchorage and made illegal campaign contributions to legislative candidates outside his own district. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.